Hey, what's up, guys? On this episode of Muscle Minds, Dr. Scott and I are going to discuss the strategies that I've used in the last 6 months to bring up my back.
Advices Radio Network.
The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for informational and educational purposes only.
Better, stronger, faster. A man barely alive, faster. Stronger, faster. Steve Austin, faster. Be that man.
Better than he was before.
Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. Our programming is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You could use our code ADVICES for some additional savings. High quality. Everything is third-party tested. Great supplements. Especially for the apocalypse here. You want to have some protein on hand, Scott. How you doing, man? Yeah.
I just bought a 1,000-pound pallet of protein just in case.
Just in case.
Yeah.
Right.
It takes up my second bedroom. It's nice. All you walk in and it's just a wall of protein.
Now you
I just go in there and scoop out of the bag.
We've seen so many cool videos from you, Scott, of being inventive. You were, you know, I think everybody who follows you knows that you've been stranded and that's why you've been away ever since before I saw Scott at the Arnold. We hung out for a minute. I got a tour of his RV. He got stranded in Illinois on the Jim Gypsy tour doing seminars. Finally, after getting the vehicle fixed, he's home. Scott, those videos you posted, guys, go to his Instagram, Fortitude Training. He was doing all sorts of great exercises, like basically like using fences and pieces of lumber and
just whatever I could find.
Scrap materials around, man. That was cool. That was really cool.
Yeah. I actually was on my way home at that point in time. The tour's not going to go down.
Yeah.
Because the pandemic and the apocalypse is coming.
Yeah.
I was just trying to get back.
Yeah.
So it was just too much fun. It's funny because I think other people are seeing this. People always said, how do you come up with all those weird exercises? And I've just kind of had that proclivity over the years to just like sometimes it's been out of necessity, you know, since I've gotten older and, you know, lots of things ache a little bit. You know, you got niggles who are always creeping into the workout. So I had to find new things to do. But people are figuring out that you can do that. Like, there's all sorts of cool shit.
Yeah.
Like this Moroccan Thunder guy we've just been talking to has sent you some things.
Well, we should give him a shout out then. In that case, I was going to wait to the end, but he's listened to our show for a long time now. I met him, Scott, a couple years back. Yeah, he was at the Western Michigan, and he looked fantastic. We were just talking before the show. I'll go to let me see if I can do a screen share here for the audience. Yeah, here we go. I think this is working. Let me see here. I don't know if anybody can see that. I don't know if it's actually working the way I want it to yet. Give it just a second here. They can see my, desktop. I don't think they can see the apps though, but, nonetheless, I'll turn that off. But he was making plates out of, concrete. It looked like poured concrete and, you know, he's got a pulley system set up. Like
it was brilliant.
Yeah. You could buy pulleys and stuff for your, you know, just hook it up in the rafters of your basement and everything. Great bodybuilder too. I know he was a light heavyweight previously. He had, I think, stopped training for a while, sized down a little bit, competed at middleweight at the Western. He did really well. Looked fantastic. Incredible skin. He's got that Moroccan skin. You know, I think that's what it is. Really nice glow to it and everything. And you know, skin's an important aspect of your bodybuilding too. I can get a screen capture that I can pull up here for everybody. I told him I'd give him a shout out because he said he'd listened to the show a long time. He was thinking about moving here to Michigan. Actually, I can't, man. I'm not even going to try. I'm having technology issues over here. Apparently,
I saw a picture of some islands, like a volcanic island somewhere. Was that
there's all settings that need to be changed in order to bring it up. But anyway, listen. What do you say we get on topic then? In that case.
All right. Okay, you got a good one.
So this is a topic that I've been wanting to talk about for a while, and it's one of those things, Scott, where when you have work to do, like you can either like talk about it while you're doing it, or you can just freaking do it. And it's taken me a long time to make some good progress, but I'll go back to 2017. I had just finished the Western Michigan. I competed all season. I dieted that year from the beginning of February, maybe middle of February, all the way through November, and started competing in July and competed through the whole season, man. And it was fun. I had a blast. I learned a lot.
Yeah.
And then I looked at my physique.
You're shredded. You're absolutely like ripped to shreds.
Thanks, man. Well, here's the thing. I've always been able to, well, I've always prided myself on pushing to until I can get to that level of condition. You know, that's like, that's what I know my thing is, you know? And so in order for me to be okay on stage, I feel that I want to look that way. I want to be the leanest guy up there, you know? But, you know, after this, I was analyzing my physique and I saw that my back thickness had come up, but my back width didn't seem to have come up as well. And I started talking with you. I started talking with Jordan Peters. We actually recorded a podcast about it. You had given me some suggestions. And since then, I've thought about those suggestions. It's taken me a long time. And maybe about 6 months ago, I feel like I really, truly started embracing a lot of the things I've been, it took me a long time to transition into it. I slowly started making the transition back then, 2017. But I'd say by about like 6 months ago, I made like the full Scott Stevenson transformation. I became willing to change my split.
You took the blue pill, which
I did. And for the last 2 years, I've been following some suggestions that you had given me. In the last 6 months, everything has really started to come together. And that's what I wanted to talk about today. And I've been waiting for you because this has been like, this has been cooking for a long time, man. So
yeah.
The number one issue I was having was my lats, my back seemed to pick up a decent amount of thickness, like through the rhomboids, through the lower back, but my width wasn't the same. And what I realized is that all the work I did, Scott, it was all going to those areas that were improving, and I couldn't activate like under the armpit. I don't know if you remember what you had told me, but one of the things you said is try to start, you know, break this down. And if we can look at what I've done, maybe we can help some other people. The first thing you had said is try to start pre-exhausting, you know, the muscles that aren't working properly. Try to get them pre-activated. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the exercises you suggested I did?
I mean, no, I don't, but I know what I probably would have said, you know, okay. I guess I'm thinking like cross cable pull downs. Maybe it was one coming out wide like this.
Eventually. Yeah. Eventually I got to that one. That was one you suggested to me.
The big one was
pullovers.
I was about to say pullovers. Yep. There's pullovers can be done so many different ways, but yeah.
Yeah. Pullovers are the first one. So what I started doing was I started every workout with pullovers, and it's kind of like an isolation movement because you're not using your rhomboids, right?
And they're still activated. I mean, otherwise your shoulders would just like your shoulder blades would be all over the place.
Okay.
But yeah, they're not a prime mover.
Okay.
In that way, yeah, or they're not thought of in that way, at least.
Yeah. So
what's going at the shoulder joint?
By doing that, then when I went into any type of a pull down movement next, I could feel it a lot more in my lats. It's like I had to get the blood in there first, get that activation going, you know?
Yeah, there's probably a couple things. One, there's going to be a neurological effect there.
Yeah.
So you've already brought your mind's attention to that muscle group, and you're focusing on the lats along the outer edges of the lats on those fibers. So you've already started off in that. It's imagine if you're a sprinter and, you know, one of the things that your sprinting coach has told you is you need to have better leg drive pulling your leg through and getting your knees through. So you start by, you know, doing some like high jumps where you're pulling your knees up towards your chest.
Yeah.
Your hip flexors being activated. So that's already into your mind. You've already like activated that motor program. And it's there consciously and it's there in terms of the motor cortex as well. So then you go and you start to do the sprints. You're consciously thinking about that and you've already practiced doing it. You've already developed basically that aspect of the skill of running that you want to be able to do when you're running. So now you've already practiced the skill of activating your lats that you want to be able to apply when you're doing the more traditional exercises by doing the pullovers.
Yeah.
So you've fine tuned the skill of the mind muscle connection with your lats.
That's exactly what it was. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's the pump. Then there's the fatigue that's there. Now you've also created a weak link, so to speak, such that if let's say, imagine a fresh scenario where no muscle has been pre-fatigued whatsoever, no aspect of your back has. And in that case, let's say your teres major and your biceps tend to be where you get a lot of activation, and that's sort of where the weak link is, and that's where you kind of give out. Like that's, you start to feel your arms near the end of every set rather than your lats being the weak link in the biomechanical chain of the pull down. Now you've created the weak link physiologically in terms of fatigue in the lats. So your sets come to an end because the lats can no longer be activated. Ideally, if you get up like a you know, sort of an idealistic optimal mind muscle connection, the failure happens because of the target muscle, which is your lats, not the biceps or the teres or something else.
Yes.
Rep or whatever it may be.
So, and we've talked about that before, the pre-fatiguing, you've brought in some studies even to say that pre-fatiguing does work.
It's funny, the conclusions of those studies suggest that they don't think that it does, but they don't take into account that EMG it will go down because of this phenomenon known as muscle wisdom. So when a muscle is fatigued, the nervous system recognizes that, and it reduces the electrical activity to the muscle to match its contractile state.
Okay.
So you would expect, if you pre-fatigued a muscle, that the EMG to that muscle would be less, an integrated EMG signal, if you measure it that way.
Yeah.
So when they do the test, pre-fatigued versus fresh, they would see, like, literally in the two studies I'm thinking of, they pre-fatigued the pecs and had the people do presses, and they saw the same integrated EMG over the course of the exercises, and the pecs are like, oh, okay, well, then it didn't do anything.
Yeah.
There's no greater activation. It's like, well, if it were pre-fatigued, you're going to see less activation. That's normally what happens. So the fact that it's the same suggests there was an effect. You just aren't able to see it because you're not taking into account the normal neural impact of fatigue on activation. So anyway, that's the abbreviated version of that whole deal.
Okay. And but people can go back if we could. I can't remember what episode that was, but it was a good talk. Yeah. But yeah, so that made a big difference. And I have to preface everything we're talking about here first with that, because Scott, to me, that was like almost like a physical therapy. You know, I was exercising a muscle that I wanted to grow, but it wasn't activating properly. And I had trained, you know, for years that way. And as I learned this process, I continued to train the way I've always trained. I didn't change anything else. I, you know, did the same split, the same amount of sets and reps. And the first step I made was this pre-activation and really focusing on getting just the lat itself to fire. And then I could feel it. And from there, if I were to say, do that, do pullovers, then go to a pull down, you know, of course I'd feel the lats really well in the pull down. And then when I'd go to a row, I would continue to feel the lats in the row, versus in the past, it would all go to rhomboid and I would feel the pump was just different now. So I have to say that was the number one aspect. Then number two, this has also been a long transition, was changing my frequency. Now, we did a podcast not too long ago. If you look at it, I can't remember which number it was, but the topics were high carb versus low carb dieting and high frequency versus low frequency.
Right.
And we ended up getting just recently, somebody went back and they watched that, or they just looked at it. And the guy said, you know, stop trying to reinvent the wheel. Tons of pros, most, you know, 99% of all the pros out there have trained one time a week, and that worked, trained everything once a week. And that worked. So why would you want to reinvent it? And
well,
I mean,
you don't look like a pro.
Right. Right.
How about that? That's a good reason. If it's not working for me,
you know, and listen, so here's the deal, Scott, I had trained, you know, every body part once a week. I don't even know all my bodybuilding, all of it, you know, years, decade plus, you know, 15 years. And when I was a kid, that's what I did mostly. I didn't get the results I wanted, obviously. And that's training my ass off, working with people that were people that were pros, even, you know, working with guys like Shelby Starnes, you know, who had a tremendous physique, you know, taking the right supplements, taking the right super supplements, taking, you know, eating as much food as I could. And I still was lacking in the progress. So my thought was, you know, okay, maybe I need to change this. And Scott, I got to tell you, man, first of all, I'm going to pull this picture up because this is where I finally 6 months ago, finally made a switch to increasing my frequency of training. And you've seen that before and after picture, and it's not huge, man. It's not like I'm going to go step on a pro stage today, but for 6 months of development, you know, considering that I was stuck in that same place for a long, long time, I feel like that this was tremendous progress. So I'm super grateful I was able to do this. And Scott, this all came, I think, from learning to first activate the lats, and then B, changing that frequency. And that's what it came down to, man. But I got to tell you, Scott, it was so hard to switch from the same old that I had always been doing. It was so ingrained in me, man. I mean, it took me listening to you for years, literally.
Right. Yeah. I spent probably a decade flopping around back, because I've been doing this for almost 40 years now. I probably spent a decade just training with super high volume and doing it, you know, like in that way. And it wasn't working for me either. And that comment, like, this is what the pros do. You know, you could say the same thing. And if you say this, it just sounds just ridiculous, but it's like, so if you want to be as fast as Usain Bolt, why don't you just start running the way he started running? Just go back to what he did at the beginning of his training regime, and just, then you'll be as fast as him.
Yeah.
It's like, no. The people who are pros, most of them, not all of them, even someone like John Meadows, for instance, he's a great example, because he had to battle tooth and nail to get his pro card. But he was winning his state show right off the bat. He's actually a really impressive athlete. He can do all sorts of he got a very high vertical jump. He was a sprinter when he was a kid. He was a very fast kid. He's got really good, and he trained at Westside for a while and at a pretty young age, when he hadn't even really focused on powerlifting like many of those guys do. So John has great physical attributes.
Yeah.
You look at almost all the pros, and this is in my, you know, Why You Don't Look a Pro talk that I do, and they just started training and they just grew like weeds, like right off the bat. So there's just like, there's really no logic in making that statement as far as I see it, because you do what the pros do and it doesn't work for you, then why would you keep doing it? Like,
well, it's funny too, because the more I've coached, I've had the opportunity to work with people that are very gifted genetically. You know, the longer you've done it, the more good people come to you. And it's funny, man, because the best guys that I've worked with, it's like they're the people I've honestly had to do the least with, or have to figure the least amount out. Like, you know, guys that just stay full no matter what you do, you know, when you're dieting them down, guys that you just want them to grow muscle, you get them to grow muscle. There's no like tricks or figuring it out, but they're the select few, man. It's the rest of us. It's the people like me, the, you know, people like yourself that have had to really figure it out. And that's, to me, what bodybuilding is really about. So it was so hard. You know, the first thing I did was out of necessity. I listened to you and Jordan about my chest training, because I realized, and I've talked about this on shows before, but a lot of people may not have heard it, you know, dealing with bicep tendonitis, first two exercises I would do in the gym, bench pressing, I'd feel great.
Yeah.
I'd feel good. And then after that, it would just start nagging me, and I'd have to go lighter and lighter. And, I didn't get much out of it. So I thought, well, why don't I listen to what these guys say for chest? And I started training chest 2 times a week. And all I did was I'd come in, I'd do my 2 exercises, and then I'd cut it. That's it. A few days later, I'd come in, and guess what, Scott? I'd do those 2 exercises, and I was just as fresh as that first day. And I was using that same, this is the key, I think. I was able to bring that same level of intensity, so that, you know, if you go in and you do 4 or 5 exercises, the first 2, you're killing it. The last exercise, man, you're just trying to like pump the blood, and it's bullshit, really, you know?
That's the concept of junk volume.
Yeah.
You know, there's two aspects to that, at least.
Okay.
One is that your training quality goes down.
Yes.
Just exactly like you're saying. You're no longer able to produce an optimal training stimulus. So what you're doing is suboptimal. And then two, there is some dose response in terms of the extent to which you can turn on a hypertrophic adaptation. You can simply look at protein synthesis as kind of one aspect of that.
Okay.
And, you know, you do 3 sets, you'll get X amount. You do 5 sets, you get X amount. 6 sets, and seven sets that maybe where you if you did repeated trials and tested the protein synthetic response, maybe seven sets would be where you get the optimal or the maximal protein synthetic response.
Yeah.
If you follow that over the next few days after the training bout. And then you do nine sets, you've got, this is hormetic stimulus. Nine sets, you actually turn on protein breakdown to such a large extent, and maybe your protein synthesis tapers off a little bit. And at some point in time, you've got such an increased protein breakdown and inflammatory response that just simply can't be countered by the protein synthetic response that you end up producing a negative overall effect.
Okay.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Unless you follow that with an overreaching type of scenario, which I just was reading a study on, we can talk about. But so that's the idea, is like if you look over the course of a week, let's say you do nine sets. Let's make it 15 sets. It seems a little more reasonable. 15 sets in a single workout.
Okay.
And you get your optimal protein synthetic response from, let's say, six sets.
Okay.
So the rest of those first two exercises, like you said, you're good to go. And then you start having junk volume in terms of training quality.
Yeah.
And you're also no longer turning on any more of a protein synthetic response overall.
Huh.
You're actually, let's say you just keep that, you've maxed that out and it doesn't actually taper off the more volume add, but you're incurring more damage from which you have to recover.
Yeah.
So the balance of your ability to do that, and this comes from those studies we've talked about on the podcast here, where when someone's starting off, at least the beginning of a training program, they're getting really, really sore. If you look at the protein synthetic response and how that correlates with the eventual growth that someone has, there's no correlation whatsoever. Like, it's basically you, that's when you're getting really sore, you're getting this tremendous inflammatory response. And my take overall, looking at that whole phenomenon, is that basically you're just trying to recover from that singular bout.
Yeah.
But when you get a few weeks into your training program and you then that repeated bout effect has taken hold, now the individual protein synthetic responses from your singular workouts are predictive of how much protein you accrue, how much growth you get over the course of several months.
Wait, can you say that last part again? I feel like you lost me just a little bit.
Yeah. So like, I'll kind of re-summarize it. So at the beginning, you're getting really, really sore.
Yeah.
That's indicative of a lot of inflammatory response. And you're trying to just kind of playing catch up until you start to adapt just to the novelty of the training stimulus and you don't get quite as sore anymore. So when they measure the protein synthesis response to people and individuals in a group that's being studied, and they correlate at like the first workout when people are getting sore and there's tremendous variability there too.
Yeah.
That doesn't correlate with the eventual growth that they get.
Okay. Right.
And you would expect, like, if you have a group of people and some have a tremendous protein synthetic response and some have a piddly one, the better the protein synthetic response you have, the more growth you're going to get.
Sure.
And that does hold true if you measure that like 2 or 3 weeks into, actually it was 3 weeks into the particular study I'm thinking of. At that point in time, you're not getting the crazy soreness that you get when you start a new program.
Yeah.
So you're not getting all that inflammation and that muscle breakdown from which you can recover. So the extent to which you turn on protein synthesis predicts how much you're going to actually grow. So if you're a responder, you get a good protein synthetic response for each individual workout. That will accumulate workout by workout, step by step, week after week, month after month, until you get and you'll end up with good growth.
Yeah.
If you don't turn on protein synthesis very well, for whatever reason, or the other processes involved with muscle growth, like satellite cell recruitment and some of those other things, then you're not going to have a good overall growth response adaptation. So back to the situation where you train once a week, 15 sets, and you train, let's say, 15 sets over the course of the week in three different workouts. So let's say if you just were to go in, and we'll kind of ignore like the getting really sore, but if you do 15 sets, you're going to be more sore than you do five.
Yeah.
That's for sure. You definitely are going to incur greater inroads into your recovery. So six sets may be the optimal, and that's where you have an inroad into your recovery, but you turn on protein synthesis really, really well. Maybe you turn it on maximally at six sets. And even if you get it, it stays maximal at nine sets or 12 sets or 15 sets. By the time you've done 15 sets, you've just destroyed yourself so much that a lot of your protein synthetic response is going towards just recovering from the muscle breakdown.
Getting back to baseline.
Gotcha. Getting back to baseline. So you got a maximal protein synthetic response, but you only got it one time a week. Mm. And a lot of that is lost
gotcha.
To recovery. And these are people with average or maybe, you know, above or below average genetics. This doesn't go for pros.
Right.
They've got some other advantages. But now you start doing what you were doing and say, okay, well, let's just do 5 sets 3 times a week as an example. I don't know if that's exactly what you did, but
yeah, I was doing twice usually. And maybe a little bit more frequent than that. It may be, you know, twice every, you know, six, seven days, somewhere in there.
Just to make the math easier, I'm just kind of breaking it down. Like, so like instead of those 15 sets once a week, you do 5 sets 3 times a week.
Yeah.
And 5 sets pretty much gets you your optimal protein synthetic response without tremendous protein breakdown, and you get that 3 times a week versus once.
Yes, yeah.
Then you're going to be someone who will grow well.
And you're getting that, and you're not, you don't have to wait an entire week to get back to, you know, growing your chest or your back or whatever it is again.
Right. Like it's only it's versus 1 times a week, one growth opportunity versus three.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of that growth opportunity, like you do 3 times as many sets in that one time, but you're probably not going to turn on protein synthesis 3 times as much.
Sure, sure.
Because there's some, and this hasn't been studied, you know, in enough detail to know. I imagine it's tremendously variable. We talked about that, how some people are just good responders and some people respond better from higher frequency or higher volume. Some people respond from lower frequency, lower volume. So there's going to be tremendous variability, but everyone has their optimal somewhere more than likely, and it probably varies for different muscle groups.
Sure.
But and higher frequency gives you more opportunities. So, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so let's just take let me take the guy's argument who said, you know, why reinvent the wheel when it works so great to begin with? Look at all the pros. You know, training once a week is fine. And you're telling me to train more often. Let me just to play devil's advocate say, well then Scott, why don't I just train chest every day? Why don't I do 1 set every day? You know, or 2 sets.
Yeah.
Why is that not a good idea? Or is it?
I know someone who did that. It's possible that would work.
Just 1 set, one hard.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If you can recover quick enough, fast enough. So that's where, and that's a hard thing to study for some. They've done studies where they looked at like 1 versus 3 sets.
Okay.
And 1 doesn't do as well as 3, but that's in the context of only training like twice a week.
Okay.
So, and there is a, I think it's called the Norwegian high frequency study where they train like 5 times a week. And I think they may have tried to replicate that.
Okay.
And that produced tremendous gains.
Oh, really?
And I haven't been able to find that to read it, but I think I have just the abstract. So I can't tell all the details of that, but that has been done. And that is one way to do things. In fact, if you look at the animal models of muscle growth that have produced muscle growth at a much faster rate and to a larger extent than what you see with resistance training, you do find that, I mean, those models are like basically all day long stimulus is applied. It's those compensatory hypertrophy models, cut the soleus, watch the gastroc grow,
or the
overload, the stretch overload models with the quail where they hang the weights off their wing. That's an everyday
deal. Yeah.
Yeah. But the model that's produced the most muscle growth of anything that I know of in the literature that I've seen was one that Jose Antonio did. And he did the stretch hypertrophy model, overload model, with these quail. But what he did is he also integrated the idea that you only grow when you recover.
Yeah.
So you have to, like, the stimulus has to be balanced and actually balance in a bit more to allow you to have the super compensatory effect that is adaptation. So if you just get back to your baseline and you train again, you're not making any progress.
Yeah.
You have enough time for that recovery to happen. So 1 set every day for some people that might work.
Yeah.
It may not work for everyone else. There's a guy, I'll just mention it because it's been around on Facebook and Instagram, and it was shared a bunch of times. Callum at the Muscle Mentors is so Callum, or maybe there's 2 L's, _ the Muscle Mentors, I think, is his Instagram, something like that. You can find it pretty easily. I think you can search.
Okay.
He's actually a coach, and he was Joe Jeffries is his coach, and they did after his show, they did fortitude training. Tier 1, which basically is 1 or 2 sets each day, three times a week.
Okay.
For the major muscle groups, arms only really twice a week. And he put on 100 pounds in 6 months.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. And the whole, I mean, I just found out about this because he's been posting it and tagging me, and Joe had mentioned it too. And the thing that's interesting about that is he hadn't tried that approach before, but he gave it a go. That's one set every other day, basically, or three times a week.
Yeah.
Or two sets, essentially. So like legs on tier one, you'd be like a compound set of squats, a set of knee extensions, a set of hamstring curls. And then you would come back and do like a set, a pump set on Wednesday. And then you do like one or two muscle rounds on Friday that week. So like maybe five sets in a week.
Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends. And they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com. And use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows.
No, that if I can jump into this, so this is another, I think, a big important aspect of this. You know, you're saying one or two sets, you know, for a muscle group. Now, a couple years ago, when I was doing a 2-hour back day, it was difficult for me to learn how to bring the intensity it took to create the stimulus necessary in my back through one set or two sets. And that in itself was another aspect, because and it wasn't something where I think, like I've heard with DC, you limit how many sets you have, and then you may have some shitty workouts at first. I've seen people have, you know, not as good of workouts, but then over time you start saying, well, I only have this one set or these two sets, and then you get more out of it. With the way I worked it was I intuitively started reducing sets. I've done this long enough to know when the muscles had enough.
Right.
And I started out with my normal volume, which was, you know, two exercises each time I trained chest, for instance, or back. I'll take back because, you know, that's what I was working. That's what we're talking about today. I initially just split the volume up and did two exercises one day, three exercises the other. And I did, you know, four sets per exercise. But I got to the point where as I was building up that intensity, then I could see like, okay, well now today I'm just going to do three sets on this exercise instead of four. Mm-hmm. And then eventually it was like, well, I think that I could get away with just two because this was pretty brutal, you know? Mm-hmm. And then now I do one to two sets, but that's another thing that it's been the last 2 years of. So the last 6 months I think have been the really most successful point where I made this before and after comparison, but it's really been a culmination of learning. That was another aspect. I had to learn that over this, and it took a long time. I couldn't just flip a switch and be like, okay, now I just do one to two sets.
Right. Right. Yeah. See, the thing that like, one thing that's coming to my head is like, if you look, muscle is such a tremendously plastic, adaptable tissue. So you see these kinds of stimuli, like, the compensatory hypertrophy of the stretch overload models. And those are like all day long affairs in animals, and it can grow in that way. And human muscle seems to be able to as well. I always, since I found this study, I just find it's so useful in these instances to talk about the study where they did a tendon transfer in people who had Achilles tendon ruptures. Okay. And they took the flexor hallucis longus, which is it flexes the big toe on the foot.
Okay.
So they just took that tendon and they attached it to the heel bone, the calcaneus, in place of the Achilles. And in this particular study, they just used MRI to measure the cross-section area of that muscle and compared it in the operated leg to the control leg, the leg that hadn't had an injury. And I think the highest they found was that in one person, the size of that muscle compared to the contralateral limb was 103% greater.
Okay.
It was twice as big. That's tremendous. And that's be like a bodybuilder with twice as much muscle mass than he would have otherwise, which is incredible. And this was like a year or two after that. So muscle can grow from that all day long type of situation. But we can't do that in the gym. You can't go and train your whole body like 8 hours a day every day because your nervous system would poop.
Right.
And then you get sick and your endocrine and immune system be out, and it's just not feasible whatsoever from a physiological perspective.
Yeah.
But you're right, a single set like that, especially because resistance exercise is such an unnatural act of lifting and lowering, the lowering in particular producing muscle damage and being a really strong stimulus for growth.
Yeah.
You can if you train like there's a gun to your head, and this people have demonstrated this, like Callum, like you, all the people who've had really good success with DC training, and you can get used to that and incrementally adjust the weight as you adapt, basically apply progressive overload, push your loads, beat the logbook, continue to beat the logbook as you get stronger and support that with the food, then a minimal amount of volume is enough to produce a stimulus because muscle is such a badass tissue. It can adapt to that.
Yeah.
It can adapt to all day long affairs. It can adapt to marathon, triathlon type of stimuli. It's just incredibly, it's amazing the extent to which you can adapt to things. So, yes, that's the thing. If you're going to try to do a lower volume, higher frequency approach, the cognitive, the mental, the psychological aspect has to be in place. And you have to be willing to dump everything in to a small number of sets.
Yeah.
But that, as I've said so many times, that takes advantage of the nature of what makes resistance exercise such a potent stimulus, is that it's such a high quality, over the top, beyond your everyday type of activity stimulus and tension, tensile overload, metabolic overload, even inflammatory damage producing overload to the muscle.
Yeah,
that it's just a potent shock to that tissue to which it can respond really, really well. But not everyone will do well with DC training. I don't think there are. You have to have the mindset, which could be some of the reason why. I mean, it could be a large part, more than I even know, the reason why people tend to do better with different types of training regimes. So there's that Dhamma study that we talked about. It was sometime earlier this year. That's the study where they'd studied a high frequency. I think it was 5 times a week versus 3 times a week versus 2 times a week.
Yeah.
And they used all their subjects trained one leg one way and the other leg another way. So they had 3 groups. Eventually they condensed it down to the 5 times a week versus 2 or 3 times a week. And when they looked across the initial study and they compared the averages, 5 versus 2 versus 3, there was no difference in muscle growth. It's like, so the frequency didn't matter. They also had greater volume because every workout was the same. So 5 workouts of the same number of sets is a greater volume as well.
Sure.
But when they went back and looked at their data thereafter, and we put these plots up on the podcast, there were people who just grew really well in the leg that was trained 5 times a week versus the leg that was trained 2 or 3 times a week. Then there are people who didn't grow for shit, regardless of whether it was 5 or 2 or 3 times a week. And then there are some people who grew really well from the higher frequency and not so well from the lower frequency. And some people grew really well from the lower frequency and not so well from the higher frequency. So there was basically sort of 4 categories. If you want to sort of break it up into 4 categories, there were the good growers,
right?
The high responders. That's what pros would probably be. They grew from any of the approaches that they tested there.
Right.
There were the not so good responders, or close to. There were some that were quote unquote non responders, at least in terms of resistance training. Okay. And then there are some who did better with a higher frequency, and some who did better with a lower frequency, and then who did better with low frequency versus high frequency.
Okay.
So. And there's all sorts of things in between, really. So it's really quite a spectrum. But here's the thing. So, and I don't know, they could have probably done some RPE, some subjective measurements, but those are all difficult as well. But some of that could be, let's say someone is just an absolute animal.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they train as hard as any, like they train as hard as anyone on the face of the planet ever has. And you have them try to do that 5 times a week.
Yeah.
Well, they wouldn't, that'd be just too much for them. That would literally be over. They might backslide. But if you have them do 2 or 3 times a week, they grow better. That would be more so in the case for those people, a function of how hard they train and matching their training efforts, training quote unquote intensity, with the proper amount of volume and frequency such that recovery is adequate given how hard they train.
Yeah.
It's not that for them, you might be able to take their muscle, and if you just like use E-stim or some sort of neutral stimulus, that they would grow better from a higher frequency versus a lower frequency. But the fact is, they can't grow from 5 times a week or a really high frequency with too much volume because they just train too hard relative to how well they recover.
Yeah.
So there's that. So some people won't do well with some people have to train with higher volume because they simply can't get the stimulus. They can't get the number of quote unquote effective reps.
Right. And that's where I was in the past.
Yeah. And you learned how to get more effective reps. More high quality effective. So that's kind of when people talk about like it's the last 5 reps of a set, you know, that's something like that's sort of the generic term you see that's put out very often. But not all effective rep is created equal. So let's say you got a set of a 15 rep max load.
Right.
And you go through 10 reps, those are non effective, and then you just do 11. You stop. So let's say you did 5 sets of 11 reps with a 15 rep max load.
Yep.
So you got 1 effective rep in each of those sets.
Right.
And now compare that with like doing just like 1 set where you actually go to failure.
Huh.
Some people would probably do better with the former versus the latter.
Okay, yeah.
Because for them, what they actually do for a true 15 rep max is there is no way, shape, or form, no matter how many guns you put to their head, no matter how many fires you put to their butt, they're not going to get any more reps because that's just incredible effort, and they're going to keep on doing that week after week after week after week. So 1 set's all they can get away with.
That makes sense.
And still recover. Whereas other people, like, they're just not going to train beyond like what is probably an 11, you know, set, 11 rep set with a 15 rep max. That's as hard as they want to go.
Yeah.
Like when it starts to get hard, those are the people you see the rep speed never changes.
Right.
You know, maybe there's one like okay, I'm done. When it slows down at all, they just finish.
Yeah.
So they're going to accumulate effective reps with a higher volume strategy. And for some people who have good genetics, that could work phenomenally well, you know? So there's just all sorts of factors that go into doing what you finally did for yourself and say, you know what, this isn't working as well as I think it should.
Yeah.
I'm going to change strategies and go for higher quality, higher effort, lower
volume. And for me, it's made a big difference. It's been a huge difference. So, I mean, just to kind of sum up, you know, the number one was, you know, and somebody just posted a question on here, you know, saying, ever experience next to no mind muscle connection, haven't received a pump in my biceps for years and years. I mean, we could make a whole topic of that in itself, but I mean, realistically, that's in part what we talked about at the beginning. He might not have caught that. We'll put this up, you know, it'll be over at the YouTube page and on Advices Radio, but I was experiencing, you know, I didn't get a pump and I didn't feel the connection. I didn't feel the fibers contracting, you know, out in my outer lat. But it wasn't until, you know, I actually was able to, what I call physical therapy, you know, figuring out how to get those fibers to activate. And that's what I think, I've kind of come to the conclusion, Scott, you know, I've looked at all the body parts I've had, and I look at people I've worked with, that in some cases, a weak muscle group, a lot of times, like when I was younger, initially, you'd say, well, this guy has a good back, and this guy has good legs. You know, and then you think, well, why doesn't the other guy have good legs? Well, it's genetics. And then that's what it is. That's all it is. Some of us have leg genetics, some of us don't. But what I found in my own muscles, and like I said, with people that I've worked with, that it's the muscles that you can contract the best that tend to grow better. And then I found that if I can't get a muscle to grow, there's a chance I don't have that mind muscle connection. And I feel like Would you agree that that's the foundation, is getting that mind muscle connection to work in order to get a weaker muscle to grow?
Yeah, you're with me for a second. You're back now.
Okay.
And some of that's genetic. I mean, the fact that you are able to connect with those muscles from the get go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is probably in part genetic, you know, thing from, you know, controversial topics like IQ, or various attributes of people's, at least their psychological makeup, half of it's, you know, environmental and half of it's genetic. I would imagine like that there's going to be something about, like for instance, I was a swimmer.
Yeah.
You know, I started swimming, and my back is a good body part for me, and I always felt a good connection with my back, even though, you know, that's the one that so many people can't connect with. You can't see it contract,
right?
Not paying attention. I've always had good connection there. Some of that probably is because just from the back involvement in swimming, and I just learned how to do that. My nervous system wired itself that way because I was exposed to that as a kid growing up.
I bet.
So yeah. So I that's my guess, at least. I tell the story of my good friend who her dad started having her bench press when she was like six, because she was a swimmer and a tennis player, and she just bench pressed just for generic upper body strength exercise.
Yeah.
She had normal strength for an adult in pretty much all exercises. Even an incline or overhead press is normal, but her bench press was world class.
Really? Really?
She could bench press 275 pounds, weighing like 150.
Wow.
Raw.
Yeah.
You know? And that was at the time, like that would have set records
in
a lot of organizations. Some of the women have gotten really strong now, but she's totally clean. And after the whole thing, it was just like just crazy. She had really hardwired herself for flat bench press because she did it every day for a decade, all the way from age six through high school.
Wow.
So yes, some of that, you know, comes with genetics. Some of it comes with your experience, the type of activities you do growing up. Like some of the best basketball players, for instance, come from inner cities where they just played basketball every single day. No wonder they got good at basketball. You know, they were probably good athletes on top of having practiced it all the time.
Yeah.
So, but you're right. Like that is the being able to ensure that the muscle that you're trying to target during an exercise, that's the mind muscle connection, is the one that is receiving the brunt of the stimulus. It's the one that's the weak link. It's the one that fatigues first.
Right.
The one that you're going to end up getting the good pump in.
Right.
Doing those things to make it the prime mover of the exercise, so to speak.
Yeah.
That's what bodybuilding is all about. It's completely the opposite of powerlifting, where you're trying to lift the heaviest weight you possibly can and spread it over as much muscle mass as possible. Hmm. The more muscle you can engage, the more weight you can move.
Right.
So you don't care if it's, you know, in the muscles of your palm, you know, your forearm, your triceps, your shoulders, your anterior delts, pec major, major, minor, whatever, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The more weight you move, the better, because that's the whole idea. You know, and there are obviously ways to do that, you know, in terms of bench press and the technique you use for the big three. But you want to use as much mass as you can, whereas bodybuilding, it's just the opposite.
Yeah.
It's an intrinsically focused phenomenon where you're literally trying to just make the exercise as hard as you possibly can. Which, if you're doing that correctly, the more, like all other things being equal, if the more mind-muscle connection you have, the lower your performance would be.
Yeah.
So let's say you went from someone who just like does bench an incline press like a powerlifter, and they use anterior delts and triceps and pecs like pretty much all equally in a way that it's the most weight moved. And then you're able to all of a sudden like literally deactivate, turn off the triceps, the anterior delts, everything else, at least to the extent that you can, and still maintain like normal alignment of your joints and technique, and you have a tremendous mind muscle connection in your chest, your pecs.
Yeah.
Well, then you've just lost. You're just deactivated a substantial part of the muscle mass that was once available to move that load.
Sure.
You're not going to be as strong. You shouldn't get the same number of reps.
No.
A good mind muscle connection should mean that you're quote unquote weaker.
Yeah, yeah.
But you don't want that in the gym because you want progressive overload, right? You want to get stronger. So that's one of the things that so many people run into, is they start trying to apply mind muscle connection, and then the progressive overload that seems to be coming you would think or you would hope or ideally would be coming from an increase in the strength because of an increase in size of the target muscle.
Yeah.
It's simply becoming because you're moving the weight faster, you're bouncing it more, your technique's changing, and you're using muscles other than the target muscle.
Sure, sure.
So, but you take someone who's got a naturally good mind-muscle connection, and it's been there for a while, like your calves are like an obvious example. You don't even have to train those, but pick a strong muscle group on anyone. They're naturally, for any given movement that involves, let's say, several muscles, let's say it's a pressing exercise.
Right.
The person just naturally has, for whatever reason, a good mind-muscle connection with their pecs. That their nervous system senses that from all the proprioceptive information that comes from doing those exercises, that's the greatest driver of all, that's the biggest engine of all the muscular engines that are involved to move that load. So it's going to use that. It's going to focus the load where the most muscle mass is available to do that. You're hardwired to do it in the first place, and the nervous system also senses that that's where the muscle is. That's larger and probably has maybe even better fatigue resistance because it's been activated, used. It's literally been trained for being used throughout the day because you're hardwired to use that muscle.
Yeah.
So then when you start training, when you have a naturally sort of inborn mind-muscle connection in those muscles that get pumps really easy, you've already got built into the way you are going to move any weight.
Right.
That involves those muscles, relatively speaking, like your traditional exercises, in a way that activates those muscles.
Right. Absolutely.
Really well. So like the guys who get really big pecs from doing bench presses, who had great mind-muscle connection, they probably bench with a lot of pec activation just because they'd have the natural inclination to do that. And when they get stronger, they don't have to change anything about their form or their intrinsic connection with the muscle, their internal connection with the muscle, because they just naturally engage the pecs.
Yeah. I mean, for me, you know, as a kid, I'd walk more on my toes.
I know. Yeah.
And, you know, and I do think, you know, that was responsible for my calves because they contract so hard. I don't, you know, like you said, I don't even do direct calf work. I just, you know, but they grow no matter what. Even when my quads and hams were not developed very well, I had calves. So
yeah,
even doing just like a leg press or a squat, you know, they get the activation that they need, and it's because they just fire so easily now. So that's why I think, like, you know, and it ties in that, like, I had developed strength. It was almost like I had developed a really good mind muscle connection to my rhomboids. And I feel like had I not had an intervention of sorts, I don't think my lats would have grown because the rhomboids were just taking more and more and more of the load. Right. Is really what it came down to.
I mean, your nervous system's smart. Like I have a mind muscle connection lecture that I give, and I've touched on some of those topics. But your nervous system has so many things built into it to basically limit fatigue. Just for survival reasons, it's really a tremendous system.
Yeah.
And there are things like that muscle wisdom phenomenon that happens in the spinal cord. So as a muscle fatigues, it gets slower, and a slower muscle only needs a lower firing rate coming from the neurons that activate the fibers of the motor units.
Okay.
So as a muscle fatigues, the nervous system is sensing this. It's a spinal cord based phenomenon. And the firing rate goes down to match the fatigue state of the muscle.
Yeah.
So you're not trying to stimulate a muscle at 40 hertz when 20 hertz will do the job.
Yeah.
Because you could potentially cause a neurological fatigue where the neurons start to fatigue. And you'd be using up energy unnecessarily, releasing neurotransmitter, taking it back up, and doing all those sorts of things. Why waste that? So that happens at the spinal cord. The you rotate amongst motor units. So like when you go through a set, let's say you might use like 60% of the available motor units on the first rep.
Okay.
And then as the set proceeds, some of those motor units would drop out and other ones would take over for them. Hmm. And you might be rotating amongst 65 and then 70 and then 80%, but you're never using more than, like, when you've been rotating amongst 80% of the motor units, you may only be using, I'm just tossing out random numbers,
yeah,
sake of example, 65 of those, because some of them are taking the load and being used to move it while the others are resting. So they activate for a while, they come in, they come out, they come in, they come out. It's sort of like It's sort of like if you got like 10 guys who have to carry a boat overhead, like in a SEAL maneuver or something like that, yeah. You know, and you have like, you know, only six of them actually do it at a time because they found that it's a smarter way for overall fatigue for some of them to take a break and other ones to lift the load. So the nervous system does that.
Yeah.
And then it progressively goes from the more fatigue resistant to the more fatigable as needed. You don't activate just any fibers at the beginning. You start off with the ones in a progressive size principle, Henneman size principle based phenomenon.
Huh.
Like when you are lifting just a simple exercise like a biceps curl,
yeah.
And you look at the motor cortex areas in the brain that are involved, it's a very simple movement. We're not talking about like a skilled movement like, you know, throwing a baseball or, you know, swinging a bat or something like that, that, you know, is kind of highly tuned and can be practiced and learned over years and years, just like the simple biceps curl.
Yeah.
There are different neurons that are involved during the concentric versus the eccentric.
Yeah.
So literally each part of the rep, the up versus the down, and the isometric's different too, you see different parts of the brain activated.
Hmm.
So it's going like you've got concentric, eccentric, concentric, eccentric, concentric, eccentric. And when you're doing the concentric, you're moving along that Henneman size principle. Motor neurons are coming on and coming off. They're rotating amongst themselves.
Yeah.
There may be some reversal to some degree of the motor unit orderly size principle based activation. So during the eccentrics, you use different motor units than you use on the concentrics because the nature of the you have to use less muscle or you couldn't actually lower it.
Yeah.
Because the muscle is intrinsically stronger when it's lengthening and contracting versus when it's shortening and contracting.
Hmm.
You're also controlling the speed. So if you're trying to do your reps at a certain tempo, you have to use more motor neurons to move it faster as you fatigue because fatigue slows the contractile properties. So all this shit's going on. Like it's just like, holy crap, it's just a mother load of neurological complexity. And one of the biggest things is, and we're also going to make sure we use the strong muscles.
Yeah.
Like what are the muscles that have the most fatigue resistance just to move the load from A to B? So you've got to basically, as a bodybuilder, overcome all of that programming going into the coordination of muscles, the activation of the motor units during the lifting versus the lowering, the muscle wisdom, the size principle, all that kind of stuff, and then try to move the load to a muscle that is not well equipped to move that load.
Yeah,
you're wanting to focus it on one muscle and turn off the other ones. It can be done, without a doubt. The studies are out there. They tell people, you know, use your pecs, not your triceps, and they can do it.
Yeah.
As long as the loads are light enough. Eventually, loads get so heavy that you have to use all the muscle available because you wouldn't be able to lift it if you didn't. But so all of that, you're trying to like bypass all of that programming that's there to limit fatigue and make the load as easy to move as possible, and you want to make it as hard as possible on the muscle that you choose. And if it's not the muscle that you've been hardwired through experience and or genetics to use, you got to do what you did and pre-fatigue and practice, engaging the lats and undo not only what you maybe came to the bodybuilding game with in terms of genetics and environmental exposure, other sports, what have you, but what you actually practice for a decade at least.
Right, exactly.
Poor practice makes poor performance, as they say.
Right.
So you were practicing, like, I just call it, it's like kind of shitty form for making your back grow.
Right, right.
And it's like, well, I'm doing everything. I'm doing the right exercises.
Right.
But you weren't doing the right exercises the right way.
But you would never know that. You know what I mean? When you say form, and immediately people think, well, like, I wasn't hunching my back. You know what I mean?
Right.
I was using a slow negative. You know, you think of form, and that's not what you think of, but I'm totally with you. There's a couple other aspects.
I got a thing on that before we switch from form. So
okay.
That's one thing, like, sometimes people will be the form Nazis, and they'll talk about, like,
yes,
like Ronnie Coleman, like, he had sloppy form.
Yeah.
And, like, this is sort of one of my kind of pet peeves. I look at how Ronnie did things. Obviously, Ronnie, you know, he ended up with lots of injuries. And that
right.
was, you know, because he just was – he probably trained beyond what his skeletal structure – kind of obviously trained beyond what his skeletal structure could really support.
Right.
Based on the long haul. But you're stronger on an eccentric than you are on a concentric. It makes sense to use some body English so that you do a forced rep on the way up.
Sure.
So that you can have as much load on the way down as possible.
Yeah.
So that sloppiness actually matches with muscle contractile properties. And even you can see, like if you take someone, let's say, who's got, and you could probably do this. I've never tried this. Maybe I'll try it and see if I can trick people. But you could do like a, let's say, a T-bar row or a bent over row or something like that. And you could actually do it and make it look like from the outside to an untrained observer that like that's perfect form.
Right.
But be using your arms and rhomboids and everything else.
Sure you could.
And biomechanically, at least to the untrained eye, you'd be like, that looks fine to me. But you, there are certain telltale signs that I see them. It seems like I can see them right off the bat. Whenever I'm working with someone at a camp or when I would train people in the gym or with someone, you can just kind of see when they're using their arms.
Absolutely.
You can pick that out, and you can do it too. You've been in the gym long enough. You just things that are obvious, like if they're doing back movements and they're getting like a whole lot of elbow flexion.
Yeah.
That suggests that they're actually active. They're doing elbow flexion when really you don't want to have anything other than just whatever elbow move would happen naturally because of the movement at the shoulder.
Yeah.
You can see that stuff. And even your form may have looked textbook on the surface.
Right.
In terms of the way in which the limbs were moving and the angles at the joints and those sorts of things. But it wasn't textbook in terms of the activation pattern that brought about that biomechanical movement.
Yeah. And it took seeing the development really in front of my eyes that that was how I figured it out. I think for a lot of people, you know, a lot of guys that are newer, they're not going to see that, you know, for a long, long time. So I think that's why it's important to just listen to the body. You know what I mean? Listen and look at what's contracting. Think about it, feel it, right?
Where do you get a pump and where do you get sore?
Yeah.
As you think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you not getting sore in the target muscle? Are you getting sore elsewhere like that? That's probably telling you you're not training it the way you want to.
Yeah.
So you said there's some questions, I think?
No questions. I just had two other aspects that I wanted to mention. One was gear. I hadn't used any gear for 2 years. I was on TRT and maybe like, we'll call it bro TRT for a while there, where, you know, right, kind of outside of the range and, you know, but nothing like a cycle and nothing like I had used previously, you know, for a contest prep or when I had done like an off season cycle in the past. So I had basically had for the better part of 2 years off, you know, at least in a very lower, much lower controlled level of hormone. And then I decided to run a cycle again. So that is one aspect, I think, having had a lot of time off and the doses were low. We're talking like 500 tests with a little bit of EQ for a while. And then I came off the EQ now, but, you know, nothing exorbitant, nothing crazy, much lower than I would have done, you know, 3-4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yet I got the progress. So I do want to note, you know, that was an aspect, but I do think that the having taken a lot of time off, was also an aspect. So basically, I guess part of it is what I want to say is that, you know, these pictures, and I'll post it up again for anybody who's just tuning in, you know, these pictures, that's 6 months of progress, but it was 2 years plus of learning, you know, to get there. It was, you know, the understanding, you know, my understanding what I needed to change. You know, having taken that long period off of gear definitely helped. And then finally being able to embrace some new training ideas. Nutritionally, I've eaten more, but I haven't been pushing like I had in the past. I would honestly say that my diet is more or less similar now to what it was 6 months ago. So it's not like a huge, I haven't been shoveling calories in or anything like that. By any means, it's been pretty basic. So, I wouldn't say that I made huge nutritional changes to make this happen. I would attribute the majority of it to the training. I really would. And that's why I really am now. This last couple of years, I can say that I am such a believer in how important training is. I wasn't always that way, Scott. I wasn't. I felt that if you had the right nutrition and the right supplementation, that if you trained your ass off, no matter what you did, you're going to grow. So I probably would have told you, yeah, just train once a week. It works for everybody.
Right. Well, here's the thing. I mean, if you, in the past, doing what you were doing in the past, you had been on similar doses and maybe even eating more food, and you didn't get the back growth
right
that you now have.
Right.
So people will say, well, you know, your reason you grew is because the gear. You didn't eat a whole bunch more. You know, it was just the gear.
Yeah.
But if everything, all other things being equal, you would have just returned to your previous state with – if you, the training was the same and the gear was the same and the eating was the same, but you didn't, your growth took off in the trajectory that was dictated by your new training approach and your better mind muscle connection.
Yeah.
And you, when you were able to grow, when you added the ingredients to grow, instead of, you know, being at the trajectory of, you know, going back to like your biggest back size that doesn't have good width.
Yeah, that, you, I mean, this was you, it, Scott. I haven't shrunk. If anything, man, that 6 months ago was me. You know, that's where I was. So,
yeah. So you sped up the rate of growth.
Yeah.
But the fact that you grew in the places you wanted to grow.
Yes.
Suggests that it was the training that was doing that.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, maybe you wouldn't have grown as much if you hadn't done a cycle.
Yeah.
But the fact that you did a cycle, it basically showed what the training was capable of doing for you, and it brought you to where you are now.
Yeah, so. I can tell you that my back from 6 months ago wasn't too dissimilar from my back as of 2 years previous, you know, and that back wasn't really that much better than a year previous to that. The rate definitely has dramatically increased now. So I wanted to say thank you. Because honestly, man, it's taken me a long time to really embrace your ideas, but it has, you are honestly listening to you has been a huge factor in me being able to do that. So thank you.
You're welcome, man. Absolutely. That's, you know, I'm just trying to pay as much forward as I can or pay it back as much as I can. So you're one person I'm very glad I could help, Scott. At Voices Radio Network.